Cue the music. Let's go. It's episode 18 of the Branching Factor podcast, brought to you courtesy of the good people over at Model AI. I am your host, Tommy Thompson. And this week, or for this episode, we've got another special guest joining us. We've got another friend of the show, long overdue, frankly. Please give a warm welcome to Melissa Phillips, the director of Games Leadership Network and Academy. We'll put in the applause and everything in post. It's all there. It's all happening right now. It's all happening. We used to have
thank
it on
you for having me.
We used to have it on the soundboard, and then I realized, oh no, I took it out. I really need to put it back. So of course, if you're new to Branching Factor, this we've been doing this for 18 episodes now. Somehow we're still going. But the whole point of this podcast is it's kind of an extension of everything else I do over in AI and games. We're trying to demystify all things games and discuss things that are supposedly moderately, hopefully intelligent way. And then what I usually do to facilitate that is I bring in much smarter and more interesting people than me to talk. That way we at least get the moderately intelligent and entertaining part sorted. So Mel's here to sort that. I'll just drink tea.
A lot of pressure.
Yeah, sorry. I meant to tell you this before we started, but you know, it is how it is.
Just run my show, yeah.
So yeah, I guess let's, before we get into the meat of everything, I said we should probably briefly introduce Mel and like where you come from, what do you do, etc. And we'll dig into that throughout the episode. But so yeah, how give us the 60 seconds. Like what does Mel do on a typical day? What is your life in games?
Oh god, too much is the short answer. I am the director of the Games Leadership Network and Academy, but I'm also a consultant for games operations. So I'm working in games, making games, helping kind of keep studios together and running, especially in this climate. That's a busy job and keeps me nice and busy. And then running Games Leadership, there is a non-profit wing and then an academy side. So the nonprofit looks to try and support those looking to get into leadership into the games industry, and the academy offers sort of paid courses and support from coaching and training.
And I think it's worth pointing out there's a bunch of really valuable resources. No doubt we'll plug this again later over at gamesleadership.com. So by all means, go and check out the website, and no doubt we'll plug it a few more times, I think, throughout the day, because that's what we need to do. We need to plug.
Keep
we need to pay the bills.
In. Yeah, don't worry about that.
Pay the bills. But yeah, so funnily enough, how's your GDC then? Because I realised you were at Game Developers Conference over in San Francisco. I was there as well, because I saw you like posting about it on socials, like, I'm going to be at GDC and we're doing stuff. And then I didn't see you the whole week.
I'm like, fantastic GDC experience, right? Like, it's massive and so easy to just get lost. It was my first ever GDC. It's the first time I've gone over. And I had a talk, which was just fantastic. Like, first ever experience and a talk at GDC, which was, we need to talk about games leadership, which sounded stern because it is. We really do need to talk about games leadership in the industry. And when I submitted it, we hadn't gone through, you know, the sort of mass layoffs and being in the situation that we are now. I felt quite a lot of pressure to give that talk.
On that note, like, what was the turnout like for the talk? Because I actually wanted to go, and then it ended up I couldn't make it because I can't remember, something happened. But
it was busy. We were trapped sort of for 2 hours afterwards, which I think is always a great sign that people are engaged and want to have answers. Great turnout. Really appreciate that. And I don't think I did the questions justice. There was a lot of people asking me some really in-depth questions. Sort of problem solving in studios. So I've given that a bit more thought now, and I'm starting to put some of that back out on our channels to be like, actually, I think this is how I could have answered it better. But yes, it went well. I'm hoping it will be up on the vault. Maybe they'll make it public. Who knows? I don't know how that works.
Yeah, fingers crossed. Like, so I think, if I remember right, all the content goes out sometime this month, I think, on the vault. I say this despite the fact that I helped organize the AI summit, and I couldn't tell you when it all goes up on the vault, but I'll keep an eye out. For sure, and we can try and plug that when it does. Because if I remember right, also the ones that are very, the talks that were very popular, or the talks they got really good feedback on, they're the ones that end up also on the YouTube channel down the line. That's my understanding of it. But fingers crossed.
I'll be talking about it again in future.
it's not like the game's leadership problem is solved off the back of that one talk, sadly.
On to the next thing.
No, I mean, it's good to hear, though, that you had such a positive reception to the, to have that many questions after a talk as well. Because sometimes talks kind of, it's one of the things that I'm always conscious of as a summit advisor, is we want to make sure that there's a couple of good questions coming out of it, even if we're trying to guide the talk a little bit to nurture those questions, or even sometimes go up and ask the questions yourself, because you're always worried, what if they give a talk and nobody has they have time for questions and no one asks anything. So if you're getting kind of inundated,
I think leadership, though, is one of those things that people are just naturally curious about, and it's a bit of a mysterious thing in the games industry. Like, we don't, and that's kind of spoiler alert for the talk, like, we don't really have a framework of how leadership should work. You know, we're not a traditional industry, and I don't want to make excuses for us. Like, you hear this, like, oh, we're such a young industry, so we haven't got stuff together. Like, we've been here longer than we since the 1960s at least, so we should know better is the answer to this. But if you look at something like, I don't know, farming, agriculture, that has been around so much longer, and those traditions have been passed down from one worker to the next, and it has a very set way of doing things. It's a traditional career, or law or medicine. We are very young compared to that. And so those structures don't exist to help kind of govern and push that forward. So I think we have to start to create that, because that's not an excuse. We have to start to create it. And one of the difficulties is obviously working in technology, is that it is changing so rapidly. So often we don't have the chance to be like, well, that worked for this. Great, let's have that forever. Because games change. It depends on the team. It depends on the game. So yeah, it's quite difficult to nail down what it looks like, what good leadership looks like.
And I mean, I come from a traditional software engineering background as well. And so I've done work even with, in fact, if you go and catch the Pragmatic Engineer Substack written by Gerge Oroz, I used to work with Gerge 10 plus years ago when we were both software engineers. And one of the things he got me to come and write on his Substack about was explain game development to a software engineer. Because they're like, I write code all day, but I have no idea how video games are made. And then trying to explain, it's like, games are sort of like capturing lightning in a bottle twice. You capture it the first time and you go, now imagine this with a lot more money behind it and hopefully less bugs. And then you try and do the whole thing all over again with a massive team behind it. And it's like, trying to explain the production realities of that was, I found that even challenging, just trying to explain, like, oh, why don't you do this or these things that are very common in software development? And sometimes the answer is because it doesn't fit the mode of game development. And other times it was, no, actually, that's a perfectly valid point. Why don't we do that in video games? Shrug. I am but one man in a sea of middle-aged white game developers. So I guess coming back to it a little bit, when we talk about, I realize this is a big question. When we talk about games leadership, what is it, and from your perspective, I guess, what is it that we're actually referring to? What's the onus, the focus of that?
So I think there's this idea from being a master at something. You know, when we talk about being an expert or a master of your craft, that comes back to haunt me all the time. And it's this idea of a master is not somebody who knows everything and is brilliant or the best at one thing. It's actually, when we look at the definition of what it means to be a master or an expert of your craft, it means that you have the knowledge of different spaces within that craft that you can bring together in order to kind of create a best chance solution for everybody around you. And I think when we look at leadership and we understand it from that space, it's about how do we raise firstly the awareness within the leader themselves of all these different spaces, so that they can have that knowledge that will give them the power then to understand and make decisions that actually will have impact and effectiveness in that space. So for me, number one, it's about raising awareness. How do we just bring knowledge to people, and also in a space where people can go, maybe that wasn't great what I did, and have that understanding then to make that change? Because it's not until you get that awareness that you can create a change. So at its bare bones, that's what games leadership is about. How can you raise awareness of the issues and the challenges in the games industry, talk about them in a safe space so that people can be like, ah, yes, I see that that's why that didn't work out for me, or I could have done that better, or maybe next time when this comes, I'll have a better plan. And I think that's what leadership is about. When we talk about that fast-paced and that ever-changing, and that there isn't a perfect model, it's about trying to bring the best possible solution, or good enough sometimes.
You know, even just like I think you said there about awareness, I think that's such an important part of it, because so many games companies, you know, even the very big ones, when you think about very big game studios now, they started out as a team of like 3-4 people in a room smashing something out, and then, oh, they have a hit, or they have a couple of hits under their belt, and suddenly there's the weight of expectation, there's the opportunity for them to go bigger. And what tends to happen is studios get bigger. They try to go for loftier projects, more loftier ambitions, and then you've got a bunch of people who now have to manage and lead, as you so rightly put or point out. And then subsequently, so, well, how do we do that? You know, are we equipped to do this? Like, and I think that's where a lack of knowledge or a lack of education on this sort of thing is often like so important. Because people just rise up and they don't have that framework around them to bootstrap them, I guess, for that role.
And sometimes it's that they also don't want it. You know, games is a funny situation, right? You can start to create a game in your bedroom with those four friends, and suddenly now you're running a multi-million dollar business that you didn't intend to be running. and you've got mouths to feed and HR to control and ask questions to, and accounts and all of those things. And that's particularly in the indie space. You know, all it takes is for one to go viral and all of a sudden they've got this massive business on their hands. And so in that situation, you know, you can see that there can be a reluctance or resentment even of now I have to, you know, all I wanted to do was make cool stuff. Now I'm managing a business with people who rely on me. And that pressure can be massive, you know, especially because these are people that haven't got business degrees. They haven't gone and studied business with the intention of running a business. This is now kind of a side gig that they have to suddenly figure out, well, you know, how do accounts work? What is fair employment, legal employment? And what do I need in order to support me in order to do all of these things? And often they're a bottleneck. All leaders are, you know, that's part of the burden of leadership, is that you become this bottleneck because everything has to then be signed off by you. So how do you then create a new space that frees you up and allows you to do the things that you do, or let go of some of the things that you now need to go because your identity is changing?
Because quite often the people that are in that position just want to do the thing that they were doing to begin with. And it's, you know, you and I have had this conversation in private a couple of times, because both of us now small business owners, and I'm like, I just want to make YouTube stuff. But now I've you know, like,
now I'm planning.
The tax year ends mere days from now. Fortunately, my accounts are good. But it is. It's like, oh, I got to do my self-assessment needs done next week because it's the turn of the year, and then I need to go speak to my accountant. All these biz dev things that you have to deal with. And funnily enough, running an indie company with our mutual friend Matt, terribly, might I add, we were not good at this, has taught me a lot about how to run this one a little bit better. But I guess even then, because you do, like you said, you do a lot of operations consultancy, you actually work with a bunch of indie studios as well. It seems like that's probably helped you cut your teeth really well. Because a lot of the things you're talking about here, where it's like, oh, small teams, sudden success, a lot of like money's coming in, how do we manage? That's your bread and butter for a lot of these companies you work for. And they're just like, we just want to make the games, man.
Yes, and that also gives me a lot of pleasure, like in terms of like my career and what I want to do. You know, I am creative, but I also like to enable creativity And look, let's face it, sort of operations is an interesting thing because it sounds simple. It's like all of these things by themselves are straightforward. It's not rocket science. You learn the language of accountancy, and therefore you can do the books for your financial year. But that takes time. And that, you know, accountants can study for 8-10 years and still not be perfect in that space. And what we're trying to ask people to do in that space is to manage the books, be a lawyer, have, you know, understanding of HR and legal employment, being able to also maybe help with production and hiring and onboarding and offboarding, keeping all of the documents secure, making sure that people are well and ensuring well-being in the studio. Like it's such a vast job, which in a AAA studio might have one person doing each of those things, but actually in an indie scene, we don't have that. That luxury normally.
Even having one person that does all this is actually.
And it's an also creative director. Yeah.
Right. It is. I've literally worked with studios where it's like, who deals with this? Oh, right. So the creative director does all these things, and then like the CFO does these things, and the CTO does these things. Yeah. And it's like, all right. So all the admin of the business is actually orchestrated by like the top three creatives of the company, which, okay. I mean, sometimes that's the reality of it, just because you've only got so much money going around. But yeah, it's funny though, because I do think, reflecting on your wonderful self, I find this, I don't know if I've ever said this, but I did think it's interesting to see this is the direction you've went now after we first met years ago when you were at BAFTA. At the time, the big thing that you were involved in was Young Game Designers, the BAFTA YGD program, which if you haven't seen it, go check it out. It's wonderful. It's encouraging young people to get involved in game development. And God, I've met some of the people that came through the YGD and they're horribly talented. Like, you know, that way you meet them and go, oh God, I'm going to be working for you in like 5 years. This is terrifying. They're like, look, I've got a game out on iOS or something. Like, fuck's sake. What? Meanwhile, I'm trying to get some crappy little game out on Steam or whatever else. And I'm like, God.
Some of the first lot through, though, now are fully grown adults and working in the games industry and managing their own companies. I still
remember chatting with Mike Bithell at one point, and he's just like, we're dead. Ten years time, we're all working for these people. We're going to be like these old guys who are still in it. I made a game about cubes. And, you know, it was very successful because it was a very early indie game and you should listen to me. And they're like, all right, sure thing, grandpa. Okay, boomer. We're trying to get this game out on Roblox because that's where the money is. And we're like, what's going on? Our work here on the Branching Factor podcast is made possible thanks to the good folks who support us on Patreon. As you might know, me, Tommy, the host here of the Branching Factor podcast, I run the AI in Games YouTube channel. I talk about how artificial intelligence works in video games and how AI research is empowered by the use of games. And AI in Games has been supported by our Patreon community for several years now. And it's thanks to them that we receive sponsorship that helps me and the team do more, including spending time with my friends right here on the Branching Factor podcast. Supporters on Patreon get access to a whole bunch of content for the Branching Factor podcast. You get to listen to episodes ad-free and even get to listen to them early before they go live to the wider world. Plus, you could submit questions to the team here on our Discord server, have your name read out in our producer credits, and even get bonus content that doesn't get published elsewhere. To find out how to join, head on over to patreon.com/AIingames. That's Patreon, patreon.com/AIingames. And a special thanks to all of our patrons for their continued support of everything we're... But yeah, like, the YGD stuff, I think it's interesting to watch that trajectory, because YGD was all about enabling young people who maybe didn't feel they had the opportunity to get into games, and now your current step of your career is, well, now they're getting in, and they don't know how to survive in a business capacity. I only had that epiphany like a couple of days ago. Like, oh, right, this is actually like a totally natural career progression for you.
So my role at BAFTA was in the new talent team. So that covered looking after new talent all the way from young games designers, which was like 10 years of age, all the way up to full membership, which okay, God knows how old we all are now. But so it covered all and in between. And it was about raising new talent, supporting new talent and helping people in. And I think one of the big learnings for me through that at BAFTA, because I'm a psychologist by trade, so my background is in psychology, was noticing that actually sort of upgrading and supporting people isn't just about providing course materials and learning. It's actually the learning is multifaceted. It comes from experience and like making mistakes and life lessons, all of those things that make us human, and having that space to feel like you can be yourself but also make mistakes and learn from them, that to me is super important. And that was definitely a learning that I had from BAFTA, of, you know, working with those different stages of their careers, and definitely something that I think I bring into my own practice now, of being like, how do we, you know, I come from a problem solving space of how do we solve this as a whole, that is made up of lots of different parts. And some of it might be, you know, understanding the finances of your business, but some of it might also be coaching self-confidence for leadership ability and being able to make decisions. And those are very different skills. And the irony, I think, is that my background in both games, psychology, BAFTA, new talent, and working with the studios that I've worked with, has all led to me being in this role and actually feeling like, for once in my life, I do feel like everything's kind of aligned, and actually I've got a lot to offer in this space, and I feel quite confident in that. And it's been very, very good, very wholesome and good for me as well. But yeah, I think it's, like I said, everything had to align in order to get to this and be useful.
Yeah. And I remember, I think, because what, Games Leadership kicked off, how long, it's been about a year?
Just over a year ago, so end of 2022.
I think that was when I first heard you talking about it, and I think maybe on socials. And then we caught up in person, I think, a few months after. But I think at that point, I was like, oh, that's a perfectly logical step. Like, I could see how this is. And it is, it's one of those things, you look back on your career in hindsight and you go, well, of course, this is the thing you were supposed to do. But it's like, well, not really. You don't really figure that out until you go through all those steps along the way.
Do all the other things first. And again, you know, make mistakes and have people that were nurturing for me to actually learn from it. I had an issue last week, actually, which made me super grateful for the industry that we work in, which was... not a mistake, but I noticed something and I didn't have the answer for it. And I was just like, I don't know what to do. And I'm rarely in situations where I'm like, I have no idea what to do. And I took a moment, looked through like Twitter and my phone, and were like, actually, I do know what to do, because somebody will know what to do in this space. And literally just put some feelers out to like 3 or 4 studio heads that I'm friends with. And within 24 hours had a solution for it. And I was like, I'm so grateful that exists in our space. And I think the industry's really good at that. But I often think we don't talk enough about making those mistakes or those learnings and having that network of support. Often, like, again, leadership is about... showing strength, or at least that's how people interpret it. So it's like, I can't show a weakness. And actually the moment that I showed weakness and just reached out to people was like, I have no idea. And I'm going to admit, I have no idea. What am I doing? Have I fucked up? Was so wholesome for me, because it opened up the next stage of that learning. And now I understand, and I can do it better in the future. And it's so much, and that's something I'm really grateful about. So I think, again, bringing that into the work that I do and that attitude has always been something that I've seen from the games industry, and I'm really grateful for.
Yeah, I think certainly, like, you know, my previous career as a university lecturer and everything, like, that was something that I sat and thought about a lot, is that we don't talk about failure enough, and we need to provide room for failure. And that was something that myself and a few colleagues that I worked with, like, the way we used to write assignments and the way we used to build our course was, like, if you're actively engaging in the course throughout the term, there's multiple opportunities for you to fail And that's all right, because you'll still have the big moment, because we still have to get you to go over the pass-fail threshold of the course, but we want to give you those opportunities to fail throughout. And some people find that really intimidating, and it's like, no, 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 you failed now, that's fine, let's learn from it and keep going. Because that was, I think this is I think you've kind of touched on this, but I've always found this is a big problem in that we don't discuss failure. We don't acknowledge failure. We always talk about success. And even then, like, you know, like yourself talking at GDC about leadership and myself running a part of GDC, it implies success, because you wouldn't be at that point talking at that level, talking to that audience, unless you were successful in some way. And I
we don't talk about the breakdown on the plane, you know, when I'm there trying to write the last bits of that talk and the hours put into it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And this used to bug me even when I was doing my PhD like years ago, because you go to conferences and present papers on successful work, but you don't talk about the stuff that didn't work. And I think I actually did publish one research paper in my career, which was about something that didn't work. And I was, it's actually one of my favorites, because it was like, we tried all this stuff and it was shit. It didn't work, but we figured out why it didn't work. And this is really valuable. And then it's like, well, if we could just extend that idea out in so many other facets of our practice, and just being like, here's a bunch of stuff we tried and it didn't work. And maybe here's some lessons to be learned from this or whatever else. Because I think it's often more useful to find out about the 99 things that didn't work versus the one thing that did. Because if you're in the audience, you're thinking, maybe we can't do exactly what you did, but we're thinking like, oh, do we change it a little bit like this? And what we really need in that moment is for you to go, no, don't do that one change. That's going to make everything go wrong. But it is.
It might be Mike Biffle again, actually. I think he said to me, maybe around YGD when he was coming to speak to them, and he says, and one of the things he would say to the room was, I can only tell you how I did it, but I did it 10 years ago. Before, you know, any of you were born. and I can only tell you how I did it. And actually, you can listen to that story and you can take what is useful to you. But actually, I can't give you that step-by-step guide. And again, you know, if I could give you that, here's 10 steps to success, which everybody craves, and we all followed it and we were all successful, it just wouldn't happen. You know, everybody would be doing it. And we'd all be millionaires, but it's not that simple. So it's so much more nuanced. But I think having that healthy space to make mistakes in the games industry is important, and that especially is important in regards to talks about leadership.
Yeah, and it's funny, because at that point, I think Mike would then be a billionaire, because he's telling all the millionaires how to become millionaires, and then he sells that. And then
now an MLM.
It compounds upon itself. And then one guy at the start was like, I told Mike Biffle how to be successful and I didn't monetize it. God damn it. but yeah, I think I think we're in a better... Well, I'll be interested to hear your take on it. I think that the industry is more willing to have these conversations now than they were even a few years ago. And I don't think it's just a reaction to the massive amount of redundancies that are happening across the sector. I think we're seeing, particularly indie studios are now growing up. Like, it's funny, we talk about Mike and we bring up Mike a couple of times. And even, I was going to say, I put Mike in the sort of, you know, William Pugh and like kind of Rami Ismail, like that generation doesn't really exist anymore. You don't get that kind of, you know, and the fact is that most of those people, you can name them because they were this particular subset of indies who blew up at that phase of their career. It's not often you see something like that. Every now and then you get a Bellatro, or you get a Vampire Survivors. But they're increasingly rare. I think the thing that we're not talking about is the number of indie games that come out in between those titles is so much more now. And so you've got these people needing leadership, but also the people that have survived for a decade or longer in this space going, right, you know, what's the skill sets that we need? And I think even at AAA, like, we're just, what are we doing wrong? What do we need to do what do we need that is different as well? I think particularly when you think about COVID and moving to work from home, and like that culture that's been, have you interacted much with studios at that kind of higher level? And what's the kind of challenges maybe that they're experiencing?
Yeah, absolutely. So gosh, Games Leadership Network is a non-profit organisation. So last year we saw, I think, over 90 now individuals for coaching of people in leadership positions from over 60 different studios across the world. And that was a range of different spaces, so both AAA and indie and like new startups as well. And people in different leadership roles as well. So not just CEOs, but also leads and seniors. Is there a difference? Essentially, all the problems are the same. Like, we're all dealing with the same problems. And I can't name a studio that doesn't have or couldn't improve communication in some way. that's a problem that we all have. And that we're all trying to get better. And it doesn't matter the size of your budget, because, you know, if you're AAA, maybe you've got better budget. So maybe you've got a learning resource and people are better taken care of in terms of healthcare and the events and support that you can put on and the mental well-being side. But it will still have the same problems of, you know, again, I come back to my catchphrase of like, people are weird and that's okay. And we put them into a working space together and we expect them to all work out. And it doesn't, you know, there are things that will come up and people will do weird stuff. So I don't think it matters the size of the studio, the budgets change, but essentially the problems are the same. So communication, managing managers, how do we make mistakes? And how do we make some mistakes quickly, fail fast, so that we can recover from them and create a culture of psychological safety that allows for us those mistakes to be caught and people to come forwards and be open and honest and have those conversations. So I think there are all these, the same, it boils down to that we're all struggling right. with the same sort of thing. But it will be different context in depending on which studio. And I go back to that idea of the master trying to bring in, you know, you'll be better at some things. Each CEO will be better at some things than others. They might be better bookkeepers or better creative directors or better managers or better people persons. You know, it depends on the sort of output of that person, and their sort of, you could put a little chart up and see their different stats. So
their traits, their makeup. It's sort of this skill set that you accumulate, and then it's like, hey, you're better at one thing.
But it's not just them, it's those around them. Like, who have I hired as well? Like, have I just hired all my best mates out of school? Sometimes, yeah. And sometimes that works out fine. It's not a problem. Sometimes it creates more nuance and issues then as well. And again, you know, have I hired the right people for the right job? How are we communicating company goals and strategies? So there's so many spaces that you can go. So it's not so simple to just be like, how is AAA and indie different? Indie can be incredibly intimate in terms of the relationships that are taking place in that space, because there may only be three of you versus right. maybe 300. In AAA, but that doesn't mean that there's not close relationships happening and difficult power dynamics to dodge just because there's more people. That can either complicate it or make it simpler. Depends.
Special thanks once again to our sponsors, Model AI, who support us here on the Branching Factor podcast. Model AI provide automated game testing powered by artificial intelligence. The Model Test platform helps reduce development costs by letting Model AI's proprietary QA bots handle the repetitive aspects of game testing, allowing your team to focus on other high-value aspects of QA and get reliable test results faster. Find out more about Model Test at Model AI. That's MODL.AI. Yeah, this is still the same silos. It's still the same... Like, if mistakes are made, there's
problems.
Yeah, it's still the same human problems. If you make a mistake, are you, is the person who was at the forefront of that willing to embrace feedback and try and learn from it? And then is there a culture that will enable for people to actually share their feedback with them and give guidance, which is something I was always mindful of, even like even when I ran a university degree, which technically the way that works is like, oh, I work with like five other lecturers to build the program. and I help keep on top of that as an administrative thing. But technically, and the thing is, to the students, it doesn't actually mean anything. But it, in the actual relationship, it doesn't. It actually means an awful lot to the students because they see you as the figurehead. And so when things go right and when things go wrong, it's on your head. And so, funnily enough, that was one of the things I really focused on for so long, was to actually maintain a dialogue with my students as to, like, here's what's going on. Oh God, I used to get into so much trouble for this because I would tell them things and then the department's like, you shouldn't have told them that. And I'm like, well, they deserve to know that this is something that we're doing or something. You know, hey, we're thinking about making a change to this part of the program. I'd be interested in your feedback and thoughts on this, because we used to have like kind of regularly scheduled meetings with the students. And then they're like, oh, but we haven't decided what we're doing on this yet. And I'm like, no, we should be opening a consultation with them in order to get their feedback on it, though, because they're the people that actually pay for this fucking thing. And then they're like,
imagine asking the customer. Yeah.
I know. I've vented about this elsewhere, but I always found it really interesting how universities are very quick to treat you like children when it is convenient for them. And at other times they'll treat you like adults when it's like, sign here for the £11,000 of tuition money that you are then going to have to get a loan for and put yourself into debt. And of course this is UK, never mind US. I always find it interesting how they're willing to treat you like kids. Whereas I have a general rule when I'm working with people is I treat them like adults until they give me reason otherwise. And then I treat them like children, which is usually the one thing they don't want, because then angry Scottish Tommy comes out and they're just like, what's going on? I don't understand.
Nobody wants angry Scottish.
You fucked up. Which in hindsight, it makes it even more surprising that we met doing YGD stuff. And I think, also, what was it, at the Norwich Gaming Festival, doing workshops?
Norwich Gaming Festival was where we met. I was there with BAFTA YGD, back in the day.
Can you remember what year that was? That would have been like 20... Oh,
pre-COVID.
Very pre-COVID. I want to say like 2017 or something.
Yeah, 8 years? I don't know.
Yeah, shout out to Dan Scales, who ran that event, who's since moved on to, I think, a much happier life, not having to run that. But he was always so stressed. But I miss NGF. That was like this tiny little games festival that ran for like a couple of days in a small town in England, which was probably one of the highlights of my calendar, just because it was such a fun environment. Like, and it was also general public as well. So you just ended up with all these randomers coming to play your games who, I think we had more kids play test sure footing.
Space as well, wasn't it? It was in the forum in Norwich, which was like such a brilliant space to actually showcase games. Like, it was built for us to showcase games in. It was fantastic. and it just gave, like exactly what you said, the idea that the public could just come in and engage with game designers and students could come in. There's a massive game dev educational space around in Norwich.
So yeah, was it the Norwich University of the Arts? Because David Doak used to teach there. Maybe he still does, I don't know. But of GoldenEye.
So there's a great hub. I'm surprised it will probably become a hub. I think of like Leamington and the hub that's become. I feel like Norwich could definitely do the same.
Yeah. I miss it. I also miss the chicken wings. The Quang, which we need to get Quang back on. We haven't had Quang on in a bit, but Quang used to take us out for chicken wings, and that was good fun.
My lasting memory of Norwich Games Festival was being shut in the basement. Because
I knew this was coming.
Dan wanted us to play. What game was it? It was like a monk. It was a hard game where you played as monks, and you had to like draw a selection of monks, but then battled it out. And we were given very strict instructions by Dan Scales of how to play this game. It must have been midnight. The door was locked, so no one could leave until we'd played it, because he'd been desperate to play it the whole time.
Yeah.
And then we all drew randomly, and you weren't playing the game at all, and then I had to come after you. And it's meant to be strategy. So you're meant to strategize what your person before you is going to play, and you were just throwing down any old card, and I lost first because of that.
I had completely lost the thread of what was going on, and I could tell that Dan was taking this very seriously, and I'm like, I don't have the energy to kind of engage at this point and go, Mate, I don't know what we're doing or what the fuck is going on. What am I supposed to? And I was just playing whatever. And then, like, I could just see he's getting angry. You're finding it funnier the longer it goes on. And I'm just like, is that the wrong thing to do?
We were locked in a basement and forced to play whatever game it was. But it was a good game.
Yeah.
If played correctly.
I wish we could remember what it was called. Dan, you'll have to reach out and remind us. But yeah, I always found that funny because they had us do we did a lot of those sessions in the basement of the forum, which it has like this amphitheater, like two floors below ground level. And you had to kind of like wander all the way down. And then it's like, hello, I'm here to give a talk about a thing. It's like Sean Spaulding and I used to make games in Game Maker, like live in the room, which I remember. God, I haven't spoken to Sean in a very long time. I hope they're doing well. But that was a lot of work. But yes, I remember, actually, the other time I remember with particularly with yourself and YGD was you went up to Glasgow and you really needed someone. You were like, we need Scottish people to come. And like, you couldn't get any Scottish people to do it. And so...
Oh, it's just on the beg for anyone to come and help. In particular, Scottish people, yes.
And then it ended up Matt and I went up. So Matt, of course, Matt's from Stoke-on-Trent, but Matt and I had worked together, you know Matt very well. Me, I live in the Greater London area and I'm like, sure, I'll come up to Glasgow for this Scottish YGD event. And so like we drove all the way up and did this thing. And then we're doing the introductions and stuff and it's like, oh, so I live, you know, and it was funny because I think everybody introduced themselves and I think I was like one of the last to introduce and everybody's like, all right, aye, he's local. Aye, that's fine. Yeah. No bother. And I'm like, aye, I live in London.
There was definitely a chill in the room as I introduced us and then you came in. Yeah, like, and everyone
English
just
person,
like, oh, okay.
English person, yeah. English person. All right, how's it going? Like, all right, no danger. All right, we've got a boyfriend up the
road. And we were all suddenly welcomed and it was... Very
it
cool.
did. There was a tone. There was a tone. I remember that. Just people being a bit.
We were there. If my memory serves me right, we were there to talk to parents, not just children, and we were doing like a parental workshop. So it was a double whammy of like parents coming in with their ideas and preconceptions of what games are and what they're doing to their children, versus also English person. Chatting about it, so they were right to be suspicious. That was okay, but you definitely warmed the room.
it is funny when you unpack that, and it is. I literally pointed out where I come from, which we did it in the SECC, the Exhibition Conference Centre in the West End of Glasgow, and it's like I come from 10 mile up the road, and immediately everyone's like, it's fine, because there was was a couple of those instances where the parents would come and talk to me or. There was a couple where they were talking to you and I kind of like glided into the periphery because I could see your face like I'm getting every third word here. And I could just see the little bit of panic in the back of your eyes and I'm like, right, I'll just slide over here a little bit. Aye. And just chime in where appropriate.
Bit of Scottish translation never goes
that
with
it. I'm the middleman. But no, that was good fun. But yeah, funnily enough, I think that's the other thing with NGF was just like you said, so many general public kids. I probably spent more time talking to parents going to the Norwich Gaming Festival than any other gaming event I've ever done. Because Matt and I were university lecturers at the time, they're like, oh, so you guys must be very knowledgeable about the video games. Like, yes. Is Fortnite okay for my child? Because my children really like Minecraft, but they seem to be into this Fortnite thing, and we don't know if it's a good idea. And I'm like, okay.
We had some wild questions from parents, absolutely wild questions. And they range all the way up from, you know, like, is Call of Duty okay for my four-year-old to like, how do I best support my kid that is building on Roblox and Minecraft and wants to create a game. And you had everything in between that kind of sliding scale.
I think that's a very good point to say that a lot of the parents did actually have really nuanced questions. They're like, they were doing their research and they were really thinking. And then other times it was like, we're going to go and get a coffee at the coffee shop over there. Is it all right if our kids just stay here? And I'm like, are you fucking kidding. Like, literally babysitting three boys 20, and a girl.
20, maybe playing, 30 children, yeah.
Who were playing our game at the same time. And other people, like, can we have a shot? And I'm letting them play it until their parents come back with their tea and coffee so that they could take the children. And sure, I could see the parents over there, but I'm like...
Stopped running workshops in shopping malls, because I was just like, we started to just become a crash. And love that, you know, but also terrifying. Please don't leave the children unattended. Yes. Please take them with you.
Like, when I was the course leader at the university, I'm like, I'm ill-equipped for the psychological and pastoral needs of my job. And now when I'm doing this out here, which I'm not getting paid for, I'm just actually some of the stuff that we did get paid for. But I'm like, I'm not paid to look after children. Like, this is not my skill set. Like, oh my God. And like, the whole time I'm like, don't swear, don't swear, don't swear, don't swear. Because my first instinct is just like, they've left me with the fucking kids. Like, what am I doing with these fucking wains? And everyone's like, don't swear. And I'm like, oh God, no.
I feel like that's every game developer's experience whenever they've like showcased a game anywhere. It's just like, whose child is this? And what do I do now?
If you've only worked in AAA and you've only shown your stuff at like, you know, E3 or whatever, Summer Games Fest, you have never lived until you've been left with eight children under the age of 10. And they're just like, the parents are just over having a coffee like 50 yards away.
There's definitely been times where I've turned to you at an event and I've gone, you're DBS checked, aren't you? And you're like, yes, good, me too. Good, brilliant, good. Then we're fine. They'll come back, won't they? They'll come back. It's fine.
I'll tell you a secret, because my DBS lapsed a couple of years ago. I think it was around COVID time, because I wasn't doing the video game ambassador stuff and going to visit schools all that often, and I was secretly like glad, because it's like, oh, now I can't be put in this situation unless I go and reapply for the license.
It's a risk. It's something if you're going to showcase your game, consider having somebody on your team that's DBS checked, to just
someone in a position of leadership.
Yes.
Who can take this forward. How's that for a segue?
Things that you learn.
But yeah, so on top of all the consultancy stuff, I figured we should probably talk about the academy stuff as well and games leadership. So you've moved over, you do a lot of like paid courses now, and also like coaching and training, as well as just kind of direct one-to-ones with particular companies. Was that just a desire to sort of, because like you say, you're dealing with so many of these different businesses, you want to be able to consolidate that information and then share it out, which I'll follow you at some point. I clearly have a lot to share and need to get around to doing it, but what's that process been like? Like, even just trying to put that
long,
down into paper.
Long.
Like, what's the syllabus? Creating,
you know, like, creating content is difficult, and also in the games leadership space, it's ever changing. So you'll never nail it. You've always got to keep updating and talking about it. For me, I mean, I come from a psychological background. I am a certified coach. So that training is there first, and then I've been working in games now for over 10 years. So that knowledge kind of comes together, and it's again that beautiful kind of marriage of those two things. So how does it work? I prefer a very personal, individual approach to this, because I think that's what's needed. You know, I'd like to work with people on a one-to-one basis. I do some group coaching as well with groups. And also courses, the courses are there as the kind of 101. It's the stuff that I'm going to be talking about on a regular basis, that I'm going to be repeating myself very often to kind of give you that foundation of where I'm coming from, where this is coming from, you know, and how do we, essentially it's what sort of leader do you want to be? Why are we here? What's happening? You know, let's look at those stats and try and figure out, what are you good at? What are you not good at? And let's be honest and open about that, so that we can figure out what happens next. One of the big questions that came out of GDC for games leadership was people asking about change. Like, how do I change a thing? I'm not happy where I am. How do I change that?
Right.
And often the changes that we want to make involve other people. So this is a big mistake that I see a lot of people come with, is how do I make my boss nicer to me? How do I get that promotion and force my boss to give me more money? How do I make my team members stop coming to me for all of these answers, and I stop being the bottleneck so that they can go and take more responsibility. And the answer is really unsatisfying because, and I gave this one at GDC, and that is that you can't. You are not responsible to change and force change upon anybody else around you. You know, that's not a thing that you can do. And actually, unless we are in a good position to create change in our workspace, then I don't advise it. Like, my first question to you is it safe? Is it safe for you to ask questions and make changes? That's first and foremost. Like, is it safe? Because if it's not, and if you're worried, like, how do I make this change without being fired? Maybe it's not safe. Maybe we have to do a lot of exploration.
Answering a lot of questions right there, if that's your concern, I guess.
Right. So the Games Leadership Academy is about how do we bring everybody to an understanding of how do power dynamics work in the games industry? What's actually happening when we talk about power? What is my responsibility within that? And what are the things that I can change? And what is it then that I want to change? And if it's still other people, what does that mean? And how do we create a space in which maybe changes can happen? So it's really trying to bring everybody up to that awareness and understanding of what is it that we want. And often we're not honest about that. And often what we think we want, once we've had further knowledge, we realize maybe there are other options available. So it's trying to bring everybody up to space, to speed on that. And then the coaching happens. So coaching for me, I think, is wonderful. I just love the whole method of psychologically backed coaching. And I want to be really clear about the difference between like psychologically backed coaching and just anyone can call themselves a coach. You know, so for me, I think it's important that we come from a psychological space that has been tested and researched, and the methodology is tried and tested and from a human space. Rather versus often people say I'm a coach and they use that term, and it can mean a lot of different things, and normally it means I'm actually a mentor or a consultant. I'm going to tell you how to do it. And for me, coaching isn't about telling you how to do it. You can pay me to do that. I'm a consultant. we can have that conversation. And I can come in and I can consult and be like, well, this is how I would do it, and here's, you know, step one, two, and three, and I will then oversee that and lead that team for you. But if you want to do it yourself, then that's actually a process that you need to go through. And so that's kind of what Games Leadership Academy is about. It's firstly, here's the foundation through the courses. Here is your personal journey through the coaching. And then we can bring that together in sort of group training and conversation and community so that you feel more supportive and you understand what's happening in the world around you and meet others that are going through the same thing.
See, I could have just done with this when I was in my lecturing career, to be honest, because one of the things that I used to struggle with, and I think, you know, as you said, like having this psychological backing or underpinning to coaching like that is really useful, because one of the biggest criticisms that exists in academia, which I agree with 100%, is that you hire PhD graduates to teach people. Most PhD graduates cannot teach shit. And I can say that having worked with a lot of them. Myself included, but
and that's not their fault, right? No. Like, being very clear, not their fault. That's no. just the situation they found themselves in.
And that was, funnily enough, like this has made me think a lot about that period of my career, because I spent a lot of time. One of the things I found I am good at is I actually can teach people, but you then go through your teaching qualification. So I'm a certified teacher. I have a PGCHE, Postgraduate Certificate in Higher Education, which is the I am qualified to teach people at university level qualification. It doesn't really teach you the pastoral element or the element of how to interact with people. It teaches you the very high level pedagogical frameworks that you need. And to be fair, 90% of it was stuff that I already knew. I just didn't know that was what it was called, so I knew how to Google for it. It's like, they're like, oh, this is this particular pedagogical framework. And it's like, oh, that's how I've been teaching for like 8 years already. I just didn't know that's what it is. And now I can go and look it up and I don't need you at this point because the lecturer was terrible at teaching how to teach, ironically. Yeah. But yeah, I found that was the thing that I always really struggled with, was the psychological aspect of it, that is you are trying to nurture a culture of students, but also there's a culture within your department and you have to work with that. And one of the reasons I left my first lecturing job was because I was trying to be in the eyes of one part of the whole of that community, of that space, I was the face of change, but I was actually constantly fighting against an institution that didn't want to change what it was doing. And so you end up caught in this dichotomy. And I found I really burnt out and I got very exhausted and very angry from that. And that was what actually led me to leave my first lecturing job. And then funnily enough, I left my second lecturing job because I could see it coming. And I'm like, oh, fuck this, I'm out. And then they get really upset with me. They're like, you're leaving? I'm like, because I warned you that you were making a mess of this. And they wouldn't take heed of the feedback I was giving. And so I left them. And then... And now I just teach by myself.
That's all you can do. I think that so one of the things that Games Leadership Academy has just done, we've just released a free course, which is called The History of Leadership. It's trying to introduce people to the idea of where do we get our ideas of leadership and change from in the first place. So this idea of like strong masculine leaders are preferred over weak feminine figures, you know, where have we got those ideas from and those beliefs about leadership, and you know, these ideas of like I must change things, and
change for the sake of change sort of thing,
right, or this sort of butting of heads and fighting, because often we can get ourselves into that space of like my job now is to fight the system. And I often say, like, you know, I'm a rebel without a cause sometimes. And if I'm left to my own devices, I will find a cause to fight for.
My grandfather used to refer to my father as a rebel without a clue.
I am definitely like a rebel without a cause. And that was most of the problems of my school life were because I was fighting a system of like, oh, I'll find something to fight about. And so I think, you know, where do we get these ideas from? I've done a free course to which is CPD, you get a little certificate at the end of it. And it's looking at exactly that. So it's trying to break down like all of the beliefs that we've had about what is right and wrong come from somewhere. You've learned them from somewhere. And that might be your family. It might be your culture. It might be your gender, your ethnicity. It depends. Like, there's so many different factors that come in, but we have these beliefs that come in and create who we are, and shape us as people. And we can believe that, like, I am a different person, separate from the person that I am when I go to work, when I'm at home. But actually, we're taking all of those beliefs in that person into the workplace, and that's like when those two clash. How do we figure that out? What does that mean? Does that mean I'm right or wrong? Like, if I'm fighting for what I believe in, I believe that I'm right. But so does the other person on the other side of that. And that's complicated. And we have to try and understand that. And actually, one of the things that I think, like, the GDC talk that I did was, like, we have a sliding scale again on bad leadership. So when we talk about leadership in the games industry and bad leadership in particular, we have this, like, here is somebody that should go to jail. They have done a criminal offense, all the way to like, this person has made me feel slightly weird at work, and I'm not sure why. And we will cancel both very quickly and get very angry about both. And actually what we need to do, and then we get angry about the next thing. We forget about it and move on. Mm-hmm. And actually what we need to start to do is like exploring each of that area of the sliding scale and being like, what do I do when I encounter somebody that makes me feel weird? What are my choices? What can I change? Mm-hmm. And how do I address that? And I think that's what we need to see more of.
Hey all, Tommy here with a quick plug for an additional way you can support and engage with Branching Factor and everything happening at AI in Games. Our new website is hosted over on Substack, the popular newsletter website. You can catch up with every episode of AI in Games, including written versions of every video. Plus, each episode of Branching Factor is also available for you to listen there as well. By signing up with a free subscription, you guarantee that every update on everything I'm working on is sent directly to you, and you don't have to manage different apps or social media platforms to keep in the loop. Plus, you can also support AI in Games as a paid subscriber on Substack from as little as $5 a month. And with that, you get access to additional bonus content, including ad-free episodes of Branching Factor, our monthly newsletter, and recordings from community meetings as we discuss future content coming down the pipeline. To subscribe, head on over to aiingames.com to find out even more, or search for AI in Games on your Substack reader. It doesn't help that the sliding scale is that broad, does it?
Right.
It's certainly a bit of an issue. Like you say, like, some of these people deserve to go to jail, that they have done some very right. bad things. But, and it's not even a desire to absolve them, but I think, like you said, I think particularly certain instances it is, it's like, what's the learning opportunity here? Because because it's cyclical as well. Like, we seem to be having, as you said, we get angry and we move on to the next thing. And I think games as a culture has a really bad problem with that, in that we right. often revisit the same anger. And, like, did we not try to learn or move beyond this from the last time? And sometimes that's because sometimes that's capitalism. Hooray. And then other times it's, well, we maybe should have tried harder to fight back against this or learn something from this the first time and actually make positive steps. But
example that you gave of, like, you burned out and you left your job. The question that I would ask you there, and it not accusational at all, don't read mm-hmm. it, coming from a place of love, would be
go for it.
What were your learnings from that situation? What did you come away with?
So I learned a few things. First, that I think critically, on one hand, there's only so much one individual can do. Even when I had other individuals in the institution that were on my side and aligned with me, when you're dealing with larger forces or you're dealing with people that are in a more senior position, and it's clear that you have a difference of ideology that isn't going to change, you either need to come up with a more acceptable middle ground between you, or you need to think about whether or not this is an acceptable place for you to continue to exist in. And at the time, I still think I made the right call in leaving, because I don't think, looking at it now, funnily enough, I'm still involved with that institution. I'm their external examiner now. And I think a lot of the problems that existed then still exist now. And I don't think they've ever truly got over it. And then that led to a larger conversation of, is this because of the individuals who were in charge, or is it systemic? Because all the people that were in charge have long since left. And right. so, but then also it made me reflect a little bit on how I approach things. So some people I found I was able to engage with them fairly successfully, or able to negotiate and work with them, and it would take a little while. And then other people we never saw eye to eye in any way, shape or form. And I'm also conscious that sometimes I came across as aggressive, largely because I'm Scottish. Everyone thinks I'm aggressive by default, which is already a headache that I have to deal with at times. But mm-hmm. I think also sometimes in my interactions with them, I was a little aggressive. I was aggressive. Let's not mix it.
And so it's
a safe space. Everybody's listening to this broadly on the internet. Subscribe to us if you're over on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or on YouTube. It took me a little while after that job to really decompress and reflect on it a little bit and realize, for every element of it that I think was the failing of the institution and the infrastructure or the environment that I was in, there was equally fault that laid with me. And mm-hmm. how do I then reflect on that and build upon that? And it's interesting how some of those things that I dealt with over the years have now became lessons learned that are now utilized in other, like I say, I consult for studios. And so it's sometimes, are they going to listen to what I say? And you'll have this yourself, like, consultation is you telling people what to do. Sometimes they don't always do what you want them to do, even when you know this is the thing they need to do now. Because, yeah. And I've had this conversation with companies before, where it's, this is something we really need to think about now, because here's the problem that's going to come 6 months from now that you don't see coming that I do, and we need to try and nip it in the bud. And sometimes you're able to successfully negotiate that, and then other times they're like, nah, it's not a big deal. And then you have to sort of, like, okay, how do I then prepare us for this eventuality that I know is coming. And I've never been wrong, sadly, every time this comes up. I'm like, I can see this coming, and then, oh shit, it's here. You don't want to go into that interaction then going, I fucking told you so. You want to go into it going, okay, well, here's the situation. How do we move forward with that? Except for one time where someone said, why didn't you warn us? I went, well, here's the document I prepared you 5 months ago, where I explicitly told you this was going to happen and the remedial actions we could take. But yeah, it funnily enough, I think I'm better as a consultant, funnily enough, as a result of those environments that I previously worked in and like learning the lessons from it on both sides.
Yeah. I think something that I find really powerful to ask myself when I'm in those situations is, whose learning is this? So I'm like, I've definitely been in situations where I'm like, this isn't my learning. Like I can see things moving and changing around me, but actually the learning here isn't for me. I knew all of these things already, and I can see that it's actually somebody else's learning. Does that make sense? That sounds a bit out there, but it's like, whose learning is this? And I'm like, actually, I'm now part of somebody else's learning. And the best thing for me to do in that situation is to just stay calm and to allow their learning to take place. So it's, and again, that comes from that leadership awareness. You know, the longer that I'm on the planet, the more aware I am starting that it's not revolving just around me. And that sometimes I can be part of somebody else's learning experience, and it's actually about them. And that's been really freeing for me, because especially I'm an anxious little button. And have done a lot of work on my own anxiety, and especially from working in operations in the games industry, I am a problem solver. I want to fix that problem for you. There's a great study, a little quiz actually by Michael Bungay Smith called "What Sort of Monster Are You?" And if you're not feeling in a good mood, it comes with a warning of like, you've got to be psychologically ready for this. I'm a tell-it monster. I want to tell you how to fix it. And actually, sometimes people don't want to hear that, and my little monster feels angry that you don't want to hear me telling you how to fix it. But it's understanding, oh, my needs here are to try and tell you how to fix it, because that's my anxiety. That's me. That's on me. Right. But actually, maybe this space is for you to make a learning. And if I step back and allow for that, you will make a better learning without me interfering.
It's funny, because I think actually one of the most beneficial things, which is not I seldom actually think about it in this context, but it is useful, was actually developing an audience on YouTube, because the audience often, what happens is I often intersect with my audience kind of orthogonally, because we're very rarely in parallel, and it's very rarely I meet many of them in person, but I'll often have choice interactions with them in one shape or another, whether it's on our Discord server, whether it's by email, whether it's by socials. And occasionally when they meet me in person, I had the pleasure actually of meeting about maybe half a dozen or more people at GDC this year who were just, hey, I wanted to have a chat because we've watched you on YouTube for the last several years. And it's like, oh, that's cool. And let's have an interaction. But I've learned a lot from, like, these are choice moments where you get to interact with these people. And then, is there something you can do to facilitate them at that point, even if it is just a, hi, how you doing? Nice to meet you. Because sometimes that's enough for whatever journey they're on. And so, like, it's made me think a lot more about distancing myself from a lot of these other ecosystems that usually I would get submerged in. Or particularly in the university instance, I was submerged in it because I dove into it head first. And a lot of that actually stems also from trauma that I was experiencing at the time. Like, my father died like the first year of the job, and I really invested in the job as a coping mechanism. And so we're getting years of all
the coaching. Yeah.
Like, clearly this has been therapeutic. But you know, I realized now that was a big part of what was going on at that time. And so it's like, right, maybe don't invest yourself so heavily in these things, but find ways that you and your platform can intersect with them and support them and whatever else. And so the whole thing of now doing mostly consultancy work and engaging with people orthogonally via this platform is kind of weirdly, it is. It's like every interaction is an interesting one. Figure out how you can support it and then move on. Like,
and you can see how it's so like seeped into your identity there as well. And I think that's something that the games industry in general is guilty of doing. You know, the creative director, CEO slash business manager slash all of the other jobs that they're doing, created this studio, and it's their baby. And their whole identity is wrapped up in that space. So it's not just, am I a businessman? Am I a woman? Am I, you know, a leader? Am I a creative director? It's now also like, this is me, and here is me in this business. And it can become really hard then to like extradite yourself or you remove yourself from that situation. So again, that's a great, you know, what you experienced there was, it was a great example of how complicated it is when we start to talk about leadership, because it's about who you are as well.
Yeah.
And you know, the fact that you've had the space then to think about it and learn from it will give you that growth that you need. And not everybody has that, that opportunity. And that's the bit I think I'm trying to snatch here and grab for like Games Leadership and the work that we do. It's about how do we find those moments that, you know, at times can feel awful, or maybe feel out of control, and how do we bring those into a positive space? I see a lot of shame as well in like the games industry, a lot of shame about failure, a lot of things about like pressure, like this needs to do well. We talk about it all the time, this idea of success is often like a big mistake for like new startups, for example, is like success is getting my game signed. Getting your game signed is the start of the next process, which means you now have to build the damn thing. And then you think, okay, well, I'll build the thing and then I'll release it and that will be successful. Then it's getting the next game signed so that you can keep this process and cycle. So it's forever changing, and our identities are incredibly wrapped up inside of all of that.
Yes, indeed. Over here, it's one episode to the next, I think. But funnily enough, that was something that I spent a lot of time reflecting on in advance of doing this full time, of like, this is a conversation I've had on my end because things are going well. It's like, oh, I need to build up a staff. I already have contractors that do a few things, but then I probably need staff to help me with a few other things. Where do I take control away from? And where are the bits that, particularly also because AI in games has essentially been built around the voice that's attached to this face. And so where at what point is it acceptable that this person is not directly in control of that element? And That's an ongoing conversation that I'm going to be dealing with for the next couple of years, I think. Fingers crossed, if things continue to go well. Because it is. It's like, well, how do you wrestle with that? I mean, what's been your perspective on this as well? Because games leadership is born very... As we said, it comes from your career progression. But you're also... It's not just yourself that's running that organization. Like, how have you found wrestling that part?
I think there is always a... There's a burden on anybody to be a mouthpiece. You know, the poster child is always a horrible term to think about. So I think the way I look at it as well, though, is it isn't about me really at all. It's more about the journeys of other people that are coming in and taking part. And I'm facilitating that. But it's not about me. Like, I'm not sitting there being like, this is the perfect way to do this. That's, you know, I will be the first person to put my hand up and be like, I've made a terrible mistake and I am not perfect and actually don't have perfect solutions, because there aren't any. That's the hard pill to swallow. So it isn't about me. It's about trying, how do we facilitate this space for others? And I think if you can think about that in terms of yourself and AI and games, that automatically takes a lot of pressure off you immediately.
I agree, because that's the conclusion I came to. Though, funnily enough, it does remind me of every career talk I ever give, which is, here's a bunch of stuff I did in the order in which I did it. Do not attempt to do what I did, because none of it makes fucking sense. And like, the more you look back on my career, it's like, how did he get from here to there? And it's like, I actually joke, and it's like, Reddit. If I hadn't posted a bunch of videos on the internet and Reddit found it, like,
good old Reddit.
good old Reddit. What a wonderful, wholesome environment for sharing opinions about video games. Absolutely. But also, thank you, Reddit, because if you didn't share my videos, I don't think I'd be here.
It gives and takes.
Let's bring this to a close, I think. Like, first of all, Mel, it's been so nice to have you here. We should have you back on the show some more, because we didn't even get to talk about all the other fun things, because apparently you're knee deep in Cult of the Lamb, and I need to find out about
that. I am. I played it on the plane.
Also, you're a Crusader Kings person? I didn't know this until...
Oh my God, love it. Look, Crusader Kings got me through COVID. It's one of those things where it's like, do I need a Byzantine face map? You know, pack for I don't know, but I've bought every single one of them. Like, they have probably taken more money off me than any other game. I will buy whatever it puts out. Love it.
Because I have held off playing Crusader Kings for forever, and I keep threatening to go into it. Shout out to my friend Mike Badley, who years ago was playing Crusader Kings 1 or 2 and just was adamant that I should get into it. So I feel like I need, at a minimum, go and play Crusader Kings, and then we have you back for like the Crusader Kings deep dive, because we could probably get a couple of people to come in and just talk about Crusader Kings for an hour. I think that would be amazing. But in the meantime, Games Leadership. So it's gamesleadership.com. Is there anything else in particular that you would like to plug or promote, or anything else that the people should know about?
I would say just go and take the first free course. It's completely free. It's like an hour and a half, 2 hours of your time. You get a certificate for it as well, which we cover costs on, so you get to put something onto your CV. And then, you know, that opens up possibilities to either come and join us through the nonprofit organization or through the paid courses at a later date. It's very open to the needs of whoever is needing it at that point. So something for everyone.
Fantastic. Alrighty. And with that, we'll bring this episode 18. 1-8. We're almost at 20 episodes. This is insane. Of Branching Factor to a close. Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to rate us on your platform of choice, whichever one of those it may be. I've got to say this obligatory part. Also, like us, follow us, and if you're over on the YouTube, leave a comment down below, because I do read the comments. I shouldn't do it. I shouldn't go below the line, but I do. I like to read the comments and see what people have to say.
Platform of choice.
On your platform of choice. You can tell I've been doing this too long. I've just got these like ingrained in my brain. I'm like, yes, please rate us on your platform of choice.
A Negroni with a bit of Prosecco in it. That's just maybe.
And of course, don't forget, you can support us over on Substack. You can support us over on the AI and Games Patreon, which is at patreon.com/AI and Games. A shout out to our top tier supporters of Branching Factor, our executive producers on Patreon. That's Scuppy Pup and Michael Russell. I've been Tommy. You've been Mel. And we're gonna wrap things up. And thank you to everyone for tuning in. I'm going to go play the music, and we're just going to end this, because I really have completely collapsed. I've actually lost the rhythm of my outro.
You need to lie down in a dark room.
Lie down in the dark room. All right. Take care, everyone. The Branching Factor podcast is hosted and produced by me, Tommy Thompson, with support from Anne Sullivan, George Osborne, Mike Cook, and Quang Yoon. Our theme music is provided courtesy of Ben Ridge. The logo and thumbnail art is thanks to Helen Odell. Special thanks to Shraddha Gupta and Phoebe Trigg for additional production support. And of course, to all of you out there listening. Thanks for joining us for this episode of Branching Factor. Wherever you are in the world, be sure to stay safe, have fun, and we will be back.